My name is Russell. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Russell.
Hi, guys. I've been doing this kind of stuff. I'm 62 years old. I've been doing this kind of stuff. I know a lot of you. And I've been doing this stuff for about a little over 30 years now. And it's good to be here. It's a privilege. Last night, I spoke at the West Miami group. Of course, that was at an AA meeting. And on this step. It's an interesting, and of course, this is an Alivian meeting, which is different. And the differences are interesting because I really have sort of like a not only an interesting, but I really feel a blessed life because I get to live in sort of like two different worlds. I get to speak to at AA meetings, which is comprised of, it's like a zoo. It's when normally people don't make, I mean, you got some Christians there. You got some non-Christians, you got some believers, you got non-believers, you got lost people, you got atheists, you got agnostics, they're all into the pot. So at any one meeting, I'm speaking, I think last night there must have been about 60 people there or something like that, and I was speaking to them and they were all over the place. And I'm speaking about the second step, which is coming to believe, it's coming to faith, to have faith. Well, it's probably a bunch of things, but I was speaking mostly about coming to faith. And so I know I'm out there like the Apostle Paul was. I feel privileged, like we all are for Christians. I'm out there sort of like fishing. I'm out there exposing people to what it means to have a life of faith and what it did for me and what it was like to have a life without faith. And I know I'm exposing this concept to people that are people who are either not religious or they can't stand religion, or they're atheists, or maybe there's some Christians or defeated Christians. They're all over the place, and they're out there. And for some of these people, it's sort of like a really it's exciting, it's fun, and you really feel like you're in God's will because you have people that I can see them after the meeting. They're like amazed; they've never heard this stuff before because this isn't stuff that's really in the public marketplace out there. It's not out there in the it's not playing on TV. It's not really in the movies. You don't talk about it out there. And I'll see people at meetings, and it's like they've heard the message for the... They may be 30, 40, 50 years old. They've heard the message for the first time. They've never thought about this stuff or discussed this stuff. And, of course, most of the people that I speak to are people that got there, not as young people, but they may be 40, 50, 60 years old. And usually they got in the position where they're actually at a meeting listening to me because they've had a debacle in their life. Or something's happened in their life to set them back 15 spaces, While they were running at 100 miles per hour, and out there having a good time, they'd never think of listening to the stuff I'm talking about. But all of a sudden, something horrific has happened in their life. It could be a series of things, it could be one thing, but something happened in their life to totally turn them upside down so that for at least a brief moment in time, they've been knocked in the solar plexus and they've been stunned and they're sitting there, they don't know what to go and they're confused and they're ready to listen. They'll sit in one place and they'll listen to some, because they're confused, because they don't know where to go. Because whatever has been their guiding deal for 20, 30, 40 years, that they bet their life on. I bet my life on this job. I knew this job and this company was going to get me somewhere. And that I would always have, if everything left me, the one thing I'd always have is this job. And all of a sudden, one day they wake up and the job has like disintegrated. And they built their whole life around the job. And the job's now gone. And they can't get another job. Or they built their whole life around a wife or a husband or children or whatever it is. And they said, well, no matter what's going on, I've always got this deal. You understand what I'm saying? I've always got this deal. So I know who I am. I know what I am. I know what I'm supposed to do on the planet. And all of a sudden, one day, it's gone. It's like, well, who am I? Where do I go? What do I do? It's like everything you thought of and built everything you had your bearings on is like gone. You build your life upon something. Jesus says in Matthew, it says, don't put your thing on your faith on things that rust or that can be taken away. Focus only on God. Seek ye first the kingdom of God, and all his righteousness, and everything will be added unto you. First things first. See what your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. So you got these people that populate AA meetings, and the one thing they have in common for sure, besides being human beings, is they've all gone through, really, the egg beater, and they've all had the crap beat out of them, and they've all gotten to a point where they've come to the realization that they're confused and powerless and they don't know what to do. If they're lucky, because that's really the first step. If they're lucky, because there are some people that manage to find themselves into an AA room, you know, and they still haven't hit the first step. They're in the AA room, but they're just looking for the way out because they know they don't really belong there because things haven't gotten that bad yet. Things just haven't gotten that bad. They're here, but it's like a temporary thing. You know, they're just hanging around until they get their, you know, their life in order, and then they're going to be out there running again. But a lot of people in AA are ready to listen to maybe a different way of doing things. And so, and that's sort of like the way I came in. Not as a believer, and, you know, I lost everything. I lost my self-esteem, my self-respect, and all that sort of stuff. And I had no bearings. I didn't know how to get out of it. I was 31 years old. I thought my life was over. You know, the truth of the matter is, circumstantially, things weren't that bad. When I think about it, circumstantially, I still had a job. I had a car. I had an apartment. I had my law degree. I mean, I've worked with people that were a lot worse than me. I've worked with people that didn't have a job. I certainly worked with people that weren't professionals. I've worked with people that, you know, didn't have any money. I've worked with people that were far worse off than I was. You know, I mean, I still had a job, a place to go. I was making very good money. You know, I still had my law degree. I've worked with guys that lost their law degree. They'd gone to guys who had gone to jail. So circumstantially, I was probably better off than 90% of the country. But, you know, the interesting truth is even though circumstantially I was better than 90% of the country, emotionally and spiritually, I was empty. I was empty. Because I had lost, you know, I try to think of maybe what's the best word to say what I have lost. I think, you know, self-esteem might be a word. Lost all sense of self-esteem, all sense of self-respect, all sense of who I was or what I was or, you know, what kind of person I was. Thought my life was over. Think of it, it's an interesting concept, you know, your perception, how we our perception of ourselves. You know, there are people in this country that would give anything to be a lawyer or to go to law school or to graduate law school or have a job as an attorney or to have a car, to have a house. And here I have it all. And I'm sitting here and I'm thinking, the way I was thinking is my life was over. And if you asked me why my life was over, I'd probably give you a whole slew of reasons why my life was over. That made sense to me, but circumstantially, I was doing better than 90% of the country. So a lot of it just has to do with your mind and, you know, how you're thinking about things. And But the good thing, now here's the good news. The good news is I felt so low, I felt so bad, that I was willing to admit that my life had become unmanageable and sit down and listen to, I'd sit in a room like this. I'd listen to guys like me talk about faith and talk about putting your trust in other things, about concepts that I would never listen to beforehand. So I got to do this last night. I got to talk to people. And it's exciting because you see people who are 30 and 40 years old and all of a sudden they got like a glow in their eyes. And sure, a couple of people get ticked off and things like that. But for the most part, people are excited. People come up to me, you know, they start asking me questions, you know, about faith and about what's good. And they start telling me about things that are going on in their lives and they're excited and they're happy. It's like all of a sudden they've got some sort of hope going. They got hope going on for the first time. And they may be 30, 40 years old. They've never even thought about this stuff. Never even thought about this stuff. It's sort of amazing. It's an exciting deal. And so, and this is the great thing that I get to do. And you know, what's fun about it is I love this stuff. You know, I used to have to run around to bars and different places and spend a lot of money to do different things to keep myself excited or not bored and stuff like this, and I'm very low maintenance now. I get to do this stuff, and I appreciate being able to do this stuff. It's a privilege to be able to do this stuff. You know, to feel like, because I have faith now. You know, I always wish I had more faith, but I have faith now. And since I have faith in God, and I believe in God, you know what I mean? I believe that I'm doing God's will, and there is nothing more satisfying to me than feeling or believing that you're in the will of God and you're doing what he intends you to do, you know, and so that's my deal. So I like sort of sharing this stuff. But then, you know, I said to Woody, you know, we started this this ministry called the Live Again Ministries, and they have ministries like this all over the United States now. That are coming into fruition. They're starting up, and they're basically 12-step ministries for addicts, alcoholics, you know, codependents, you know, people that have not only addictive personalities, but also people that are in bondage one way or another, or living a defeated life. You know, somehow they're just not. Somehow there's something keeping them down. You know, they're not free. You know, and you know, these ministries where it's Christ-centered or Scripture-centered, where we talk about the same things we talk about in Alcoholics Anonymous, but we use the Bible. Now it's sort of like amusing to me, because anybody who's been to any of my step meetings, I know some of you guys went to one last night, know that I might even talk more about Jesus and about Christ and about the Bible at the quote secular meetings than I do at the church meetings. It's an amazing thing. You know, I go to a secular meeting where there's a lot of non-Christians, and I talk about Matthew and I talk about John and I talk about Psalms and I talk about the Bible and I talk about Christ, and somehow, some way, I guess the Lord is like protecting me. I get away with it. You know, I don't know how it happened. I'm telling you, it's a mystery to me. It's a mystery to me. I mean, I figure one day I'm going to run out. My luck's going to run out. You know what I mean? My luck's going to run out. And, you know, and you know, listen, I know not everybody likes it. Some of them get hurt. But it's exciting to me to boldly, you know, proclaim the Lord and proclaim faith and things like that. And especially in trying to figure out new ways of doing it so that it's attractive to people and so that they understand what's going on without me being sort of preachy about it. Because a man once told me, and I liked what he told me, he said, I can't impose my faith on you. And as a matter of fact, my faith won't allow me to impose it upon you. You know, Jesus isn't there to impose himself on you, but I've got to expose my faith to you. But then, because I'm involved in Alive Again, and I love Alive Again, and I love this concept of a Christian fellowship, you know, I agreed with Woody. I said, well, you know, why don't you do the steps for Alive Again? So I said, okay, I'll do the steps for Alive Again. And of course, not only do I have fellowship with these secular people and Alcoholics Anonymous and a lot of Christians, but I have other fellowships that I'm involved in. And I think, listen, one of the great things about spiritual progress in the Lord is the ability to have really close relationships with other, I'll say other men. I have relationships with other women. I like women. I try to help them out, but really I'm mostly tuned towards men. But it seems to me, see, if you would ask me when I first came in, I would have said I had 1,000 friends, because I had 1,000 drinking buddies and friends. But the truth is, I had no friends. I had no friends, and even the ones that were decent people that maybe liked me weren't really my friends, because they didn't really know about me. They didn't really understand me, and I didn't understand them. And quite frankly, I probably lied or didn't tell what was really going on. I had very few, if any, friends. I didn't start having friends. If a friend is somebody that you really care about, not somebody you only care about yourself, and you call him your friend because he's there because you can dump on him or you can use him or something like that, but if a friend is somebody that you really worry about, you really care about, you really worry about what happens to them, you think about them all the time, and somebody that also thinks about you, and you try to help them, they try to help you, and you share. I had, like, no friends. Zero. And I used people. And now I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and when I first came in, you know what happened? I joined a group. And I'm not saying I liked or I got along with everybody in the group, but I got along with a bunch of people, and they became friendly, and we shared stuff honestly, about as honest as you can be in here. I'm not even saying we're 100% honest, but if you're like 2% honest out there, maybe you're 20% honest in here, you know what I mean? And then maybe you're 40% honest with your sponsor or somebody that you get even closer to. And I got sponsors and I got mentors and I got more and more friends. And after 30 years, you know, the fellowship that I've had developed with people because of my faith in God is just amazing. And that's the way I think God wants it to be. It says, seek ye first the kingdom of God, and everything will be added. I think if you seek that vertical relationship through faith, You know, there's a line in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I love it. It says, let no man say that he's got to get his wife back, or a woman say she's got to get her husband back in order to get sober or feel better about herself. Wife or no wife, job or job. It says some people get these people back and they're miserable. Some people don't get them back and they're happy. Wife or no wife, job or no job, husband or no husband, you know, you can feel better and be better. It all depends upon your relationship with God. It all depends upon that relationship with God. You know, and I learned that after a while, that's a real deal. That's just not a false deal. That's about as real as this table. I mean, the Lord to me today is about as real as this table is right here. It's not like a, gee, now for a long time, it was sort of like a, you know, a wishful thinking thing, or maybe it's true, or that kind of that deal. But right now, for me, it's as solid as this table because I have a faith that works. I have used the Lord. I've put it to him. You know, I've been in, after 30 years, you know, how many difficult situations, you guys live life for the last, you guys have been around for 30 years or more. I can tell by looking at you, but there's no 30-year-olds in here. You've been around for 30 years or more, right? Well, you know, over a period of 30 years, you run into stuff, right? You know, I've had cancer. I've had people that I love die in my life. You know, my mother's died. I've had people that have gotten sick in my life. I've had money problems. I've had, you know, a work problem. I've had problems, the same problems everybody. I have problems every day, issues every day. So in 30 years, I've had situations where I've had lonely 3 o'clock in the morning, worrying about what's going to happen to me, knowing that there's no way of getting out of this or what's going to happen or, you know, things I'm worried about, where I had no place to turn and nothing to do, and God has put me in a position where I was all by myself, all alone, and I knew that my life was over, it was never going to get better again, and I had nothing to do except I had to finally forced to turn my life over to him and pray to him and say, God help me, and the next morning or 2 days later, bam, the miracle happened. And everything got set right, and everything was perfect in a way that I would have never comprehended. And I said, wow, the Lord came through. It really happened. What a God thing. And I've told the group about it. And then, of course, you know what happens the next day? What happens the next day? The next day after God saves you, I'm just like those guys in the Bible. I'm saying, well, what have you done for me lately? I mean, I know my life was over, and I know I was going to die, and I know I was going to live, and there was no life after this, and now you saved me, but now I've got real problems. What have you done to me lately? And he backs me into the corner, you know what I mean? And I know my life is over. I know it's never going to be better again. You know, I might as well kill myself. Nobody can help me, and I finally turn it over to him, and I pray, you know, and I follow his, and I try to find his will, and I do what he has me to do, and you know what happens? A day later or 2 days later, all of a sudden, perfect again. Perfect. Perfect. It's absolutely perfect. There's no explanation. How could this change the way it changed? How could it happen the way it happened? It couldn't have been more perfect. God came through again. And I'm good for another, you know, 30 minutes or half an hour. And then all, you know, whatever it is. And then I say, yeah. God was good. He says, yeah, but now I have a real problem. You know what I mean? But, you know, every time that happens, here's what happens. And it's true. And I plead guilty to that. You know, I plead guilty to that, but you know, every time that happens, you know, my faith builds a little bit more, a little bit more. Gets a little bit bigger, you know what I mean? So all of a sudden, one day I wake up, and I don't even know how this happens after 10 years, after 15 years, after 20 years, and one day I woke up, and I just expect that God will take care of me. I go from a life of expecting that I'm going to die, that I'm going to be crushed, that terrible things are going to happen, that I better watch out and be on my guard, because I know I live a life from going that even if a good thing happens to me, I know it's happening to me because he's about to whack me or something bad's going to happen me. A life of being on the defense all the time. All of a sudden I wake up one morning and I'm just excited because I just expect great things to happen. I just expect to win the spiritual lottery. It's like I wake up in the morning and say, man, it's Tuesday. This is going to be, I can't even wait to get up. As a matter of fact, I'm so bad, and some of you guys know this, you know, I know Rocio knows this, that I get up at 3 o'clock in the morning, I'm so excited. Just to see who's sending me emails, you know what I mean? You know, I'm up at 3 o'clock in the morning, I said, look, I can't wait till 6 a.m. I got to get up at 3 o'clock, it's too exciting. I know there's exciting stuff going on out there, and I live a life of excitement, you know what I'm talking about? And it's all because of this faith that was tested over a period of time, over and over again. You know, and I was like Joel. You know, I know Joel. I I sort of beat him up a little bit. You know, that's okay. You can handle it. I sort of like Joe when somebody tried to put this voice's faith thing on him. I'd argue with him. You know, don't tell me to be happy. Don't tell me everything's going to be okay. I don't want to hear that junk. I'm perfectly satisfied here. Suicidal, thank you. You know what I mean? You know, I fought that deal. You know what I mean? Don't be telling me that stuff. I don't want to hear that everything's going to be okay and that, you know, God loves me and all that stuff. I would prefer to sit right here feeling horrible because my life is over. I understand that deal. You know, that's sort of like not wanting to be bothered and, you know, not even wanting to risk hoping for something and being disappointed. You understand? I understand that deal because I was there. I understand what that's like. It's an addiction in and of itself. Just to get out of that thinking, because the thinking itself will lead you into defeatism and not even getting up in the morning, not even doing the things that you're supposed to do. So I understand that deal. But for me, this faith has been real. So the interesting thing is, so now I have other fellowships and other groups. I have a Bible study at 7:30 tomorrow morning that I've been going to religiously for 15 years. You know, that Woody chairs with a bunch of wonderful people, some of them in recovery, some of them not, different men, and that's great. And we have different fellowships, and we have a lunch fellowship, as you guys all know. A lot of the men here now are in that fellowship every day. You know, it's interesting. We were sitting at one of the restaurants that we frequent for our lunch fellowship, and we literally, most of you guys know this, but some people don't know this, we have a lunch fellowship which goes out to like 60 guys. Where we're having lunch every day, like 60 guys get a message, a text message, where we're eating lunch. And usually anywhere between 5 and 12 guys will show up. Different guys on different days at different restaurants. And so we happen to be sitting in a restaurant with a couple of pastors. You know, nice guys, new pastors down here who happen to be there. And they joined us, and they sat down, and they joined us, and we explained what we were doing and where we are. And these are wonderful men, wonderful Christian men. Good guys, and we explained to them about the lunch and the fellowship, and they listened to us, and I said that's why we're, because they want to know why we're on a Monday, why we were all together, why we were all there, and he says, well, this is our fellowship. We send it out to 60. I explained the whole thing, and so we're talking, we're having a good time, and at the end of our conversation, and these are Christian men, good Christian men, they look at me and says, so let me get this straight, you what do you meet like once a week? And I said, no, every day. He said, wait a second, every day? I said, yeah, every day. We eat lunch together every day. And they were like amazed. They were amazed. I mean, I saw their face. They were like amazed. It was an amazing thing to them. I said, yeah, you know, like Jesus, like the apostles. We eat every day. We eat lunch. You got to eat lunch every day. You got to eat lunch with somebody. Who else to eat lunch with but, you know, your Christian buddies? We eat lunch every day. I think they were sort of pleasantly amazed. What a concept. You know? In one sense, they probably thought it was kind of weird, but in another sense, it was like a good weird. It was like, wow, that was really something. And you know what? I put them on the list. You know, I don't know whether they'll show up or not. I said, you don't have to show up. There's no commitment. But if one day you're not doing anything, you see where we're having lunch, you want to join us, just join us. Come on by. We're having fellowship. So now we get to an interesting deal. So now Woody says to me, would you do the steps? So you know, I'm a Christian, you know, and I agree to do it, and I'm coming here, and I love hanging out with Christians and talking to Christians. I love hanging out with, you know, crazy non-believers too and talking to them and everything. And now I get to talk about step two, coming to believe that God, that a power greater than yourself, that God, well, for Christians, that God could restore you to sanity. And all of a sudden I start thinking, what an interesting concept. What an interesting concept. Because it's one thing to speak to a group of 60 people or 50 people or 100 people or 10 people, whatever it is, who are non-believers, or it's sprinkled with non-believers, trying to explain to them, not that I can explain to them, but at least I know what I'm dealing with. I'm dealing with non-believers that have never been exposed to it before and maybe have never gone to church before and maybe don't believe in God or don't believe it works. And I'm expressing maybe through my testimony or whatever it is or my experience what faith has done for me and things like that. And now all of a sudden I'm in a group with people who are supposedly Christians. I mean, they're believers. And I'm not supposed to talk to them about coming to believe. And so I say to myself, I say, well, you know, this is a very interesting concept. Now, what am I going to share with a group of Christians? It's like, isn't it? It should be. It's sort of like when I say to somebody, you know, you're preaching to the choir. You don't have to tell me. I already know this. And so the first thought in my mind is, well, now this is a different thing. I got to look at this a little bit differently. You know what I mean? Because they are Christians. You know, as a matter of fact, the truth is, I don't even have to use the word power greater than ourselves, because it's true. I can say to you, came to believe that Christ, that the Holy Spirit, that God will restore us to sanity. Now, I can say that. And nobody's going to walk out or say, I don't know what you're talking about, or don't say anything, because that's really what we're about. That Christ will restore you to sanity. That Christ, through the Holy Spirit, will restore you to sanity, which I absolutely, his work in you, he is doing a work in you, and you know he will complete his work. Because that's what the word said. He will complete his work and he will do that. So I said, but what's the point? Well, this is kind of like a waste of time speaking to Christians in a Christian fellowship, like Alive Again, about this stuff. But then I got to stop and I got to say, wait a second, what are they doing here? What are they doing in a fellowship for broken, crazy people? They're Christians. And then I got to remember that I know a lot of Christians. I've spoken to a lot of Christians in fellowship and not fellowship. And like 90% of the Christians I know are absolutely stark raving nuts. You know, I mean, it's sort of like, it's not that they don't love the Lord, but they got their own deals going on. They got their own battles going on. They may be at a different level or a different thing or come at it a different way, but they got their own bondages, their own idols, their own deals, you know, going on. That they're not perfect. That they are like Paul. That they do the things they don't want to do, and they do the things that they don't do the things they should do, and they end up doing things they don't want to do, and they're where the worthless. They got the same deal that Paul was. I'm not saying not perfect. They got the same deal going on, and a lot of Christians are defeated. You know, and I say, well, wait a second. It's the same deal. You know, the only difference is, really, when you think about it, they've got more of a reason to pridefully hide it. They've got a bigger reason to pridefully, you know, what was this saying we had up at when we used to go out to, you know, Woody and I and a bunch of guys used to go out to California. We'd go to different churches and, you know, went out to Saddleback. It was wonderful, some wonderful stuff they have there. But we'd say one of the guys out there, I forgot the name of the guy, was a psychologist. He says, we preach grace and we practice guilt. You know, we preach grace, but basically everybody looks, you know, I'm an attorney and I'm a deacon in a church. So the truth of the matter is, if anybody gets in trouble who's a Christian, you know, their kids get in trouble, they get in trouble, something goes wrong, you know, I do get the call. I get the call from the pastor. I get the call from them. I get recommended because I'm a Christian, you know, to handle them. And so I know, who knows better than me, that the greatest looking elder and the greatest looking deacon, you know what I mean? And the guy who is the pillar of the church that everybody thinks is absolutely perfect and has a perfect life, he comes to me and he has the most insane problem in his family. You know, nobody knows better than me that you can look great, that you can't tell what's going on in a person's mind or whether he's defeated or he has victory just because of how he looks on the outside. We could look at some of the preachers that get in trouble these days and the things they get in problems for. And I'm certainly not pleading perfection. You know what I mean? So to sit here and think for a second, and it's really a crazy sort of way of thinking, that, you know, I know Jesus says we leave the 99 and go after the one. And I believe that. That's why we have Alive Again, because we're mostly a Luke 15 ministry. We leave the 99, we go after the one, we're evangelistic. But many, many times, the one is lost and hiding somewhere in the 99. You know, I'm telling you, the one is in the 99. He's hiding there in the pew, third row back. You know, and I just got an email today from a brother telling me about a lady and her husband and all sorts of stuff who are members of the church, all sorts of insane things happening. He wants me to go out and save them, you know. He's a wonderful guy and a wonderful man. He's not part of our fellowship, so he thinks that that's the way it works. I'll just sort of knock on the guy's door and put my arms around his neck and say, come with me or something like that. And that doesn't necessarily work with alcoholics or drug addicts and people like that. You sort of have to wait until they're ready. You know, they're ready for this deal. So my assumption that somehow I can't talk about step two to Christians, you know. And then I read in one of these books that I use is the 12 and 12, which was written, you know, many years after AA came. It's like a treatise on the 12 steps. And there was something I read in step 7, which I thought was extremely interesting based upon this topic we're talking about right now. I want to read it to you. It's on page 72. It's an interesting concept. It presumably talks about step 7. Step 7 says, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Ask God humbly. I mean, I don't do humble well. I don't know about you. I'm not very good at humble. But, I'm very good at being humiliated. Humiliated, I'm good at. I can do humble after humiliation. It's sort of like, they go hand. It's like love and marriage. It goes together like, humiliated and humble goes together for me. But it's an interesting point that they talked about here. And so I want to read this one part on page 72. It says, I'll start in 71. As a matter of fact, I'm going to read most of 71 on to 72 into the part that I get to, because I really don't want to miss this one part. Certainly no, and they're talking about alcoholics, but it could be drug addicts, it could be codependents, it could be anybody, because anybody fits in this deal. They talk about alcoholics putting their faith in money, putting their faith in romance, putting their faith in husband. Well, listen, I've spoken to enough codependents and enough people that have all sorts of problems to know when somebody is all wrapped up in their husband and their wife and their girlfriend and their boyfriend and sex. You know, anybody can get wrapped up in bondage and idolatry. It says, certainly no alcoholic and surely no member of AA wants to deprecate material achievement. Nor do we enter into a debate with many who still so passionately cling to the belief that to satisfy our basic natural desires is the main object of life. But we are sure that no class... Do you know how many people do you think, and I include myself in this, spend most of their waking hours thinking about how they're going to maintain their lifestyle or worried about maintaining their lifestyle? You know, the story goes about Mother Teresa, that a guy from the New York Times or one of these magazines were following her around as she went through the slums in India. And he looked at her and he said this line. He says, you know, I wouldn't do what you do for $1 million. And she looks at him and she says, neither would I. How many people do I meet every day that the biggest worry, they don't worry about whether they're going to hell or whether they're going to heaven or whether they believe in God or anything like that. What they worry about is maintaining something. It says, nor do we enter into a debate with many who so passionately cling to the belief that to satisfy our basic natural desires is the main object of life. You know, I keep on thinking of that line from the Bible. What does it matter if you gain the whole world if you lose your soul? But we are sure that no class of people in the world ever made a worse mess of trying to live by this formula than alcoholics. For thousands of years, we have been demanding more than our share of security, prestige, and romance. When we seemed to be succeeding, we drank to dream still greater dreams. When we were frustrated, even in part, we drank for oblivion. Never was there enough of what we thought we wanted. In all these strivings, so many of them well-intentioned, our quibbling handicapped had been lack of humility. I would have never thought of lack of humility. I would have thought it would be lack of money. And I'm being serious. I'm not even joking. That's not even a joke. You asked me on any one day, you know, what my problem is. I said, I don't have enough money. I remember Claire Madan once asked me, when I was telling about all the problems I had, she said, well, let me ask you something. Would money solve these problems? I said, what, are you kidding? Of course money would solve my problems. He says, well, then it's not a problem. I said, what are you talking about? He says, listen, if money will solve... He says, listen, you know when you have a problem? When money won't solve it. When you have a son that's dying of cancer, when you have a baby daughter that's dying of leukemia, You know, when you've got a brain tumor that's inoperable, that's a problem that money can't solve. That's a problem. Money will solve the problem. It's not even a problem. I never even thought. She told me that when I was 35 years old. I had never even thought that way for 35 years. It was like a new concept. It's like, wow. And of course, I didn't initially buy it. I had to think about it and chew about it. And now it's like a part of my life. It's not that I never worry about money. But now it's tempered by the fact that I know what's really important, the stuff that's really important, nobody can take away from me. We still lack the perspective to see that character building and spiritual values had to come first, and that material satisfactions were not the purpose of living. Quite characteristically, we'd gone all out in confusing the ends with the means. Instead of regarding the satisfaction of our material desires as the means by which we could live and function as human beings, we had taken these satisfactions to be the final end and aim of life. True, most of us thought good character was desirable, but obviously good character was something one needed to get on with the business of being self-satisfied. With a proper display of honesty and morality, we stand a better chance of getting what we really wanted, the guy, the gal, the money. But whenever we had to choose between character and comfort, the character building was lost in the dust of our chase after what we thought was happiness. Seldom did we look at character building as something desirable in itself, something we would like to strive for, whether our instinctual needs were met or not. We never thought of making honesty, tolerance, and true love of man and God the daily basis of living. You know, I was talking, I'm not going to single out Joel, but that's one of the things I was talking to Joel about. You know, you're thinking of, you can think about a lot of things. How many times do you think about, how can I help another human being? How can I bring the happiness into another human being's life versus what's going on in my life? It says, we never thought of making honesty, tolerance, and true love of man. You see, here's the deal. No matter how much money you have in the bank, no matter what's going on in your life now, no matter who you are, right now, you can make honesty, tolerance, and true love of man and God the daily basis of your living. You can do that right now. Unless you're so wrapped up in yourself that all you're doing is thinking about yourself. This lack of anchorage to any permanent values, this blindness to the true purpose of our lives, produced another bad result. And here's where I'm getting into where I think the second step can be instrumental in helping, talking about helping Christians. For just so long as we were convinced that we could live exclusively by our own individual strength and intelligence, for just that long was a working faith in God impossible. Now, do you understand what they're saying? That even though you believe in God, for as long as you think that you don't need him, that you're doing quite well. You know, I'm glad you're there. I believe in you. If they ask me whether I believe you, I'll say yes. But I'm doing okay. I don't need your help. You can go help somebody in India. For just so long as you believe that, a working faith was impossible. It meant nothing. It's irrelevant to your life. It's irrelevant to your life. Because you assume that you're steering the ship. This was true even when we believed that God existed. We could actually have earnest religious beliefs which remain barren, because we were still trying to play gods ourselves. As long as we place self-reliance first, a genuine reliance upon a higher power, upon God, was out of the question. The basic ingredient of all humility, a desire to seek and do God's will, was missing. You know, at one point in my life, you know, when I was 31, right before I came to the Lord and everything like that, I was lying on a hospital gurney. I thought my life was over, and I looked up and I said, God help me. And I didn't say God help me like God help me or, you know, God Don or something like that. I said God help me because I was actually praying to God. I said, God help me. Help me, God. And you know something? And I said it. I cried for him to help me. And he did. And he came. But you know, when I cried for him to help me, that was the first time I remember doing that in my entire life. And I was 31 years old. In 31 years, that's the first time I ever remember doing that. And that happened only because I was crushed. It didn't happen because I was smart. It didn't, you know, I was bar mitzvahed. I knew the Torah. I read the Haftorah. You know, I took all the classes. It didn't happen because I went to synagogue. It didn't happen because I knew the rabbi. It didn't happen because I drank the Mogen David. I should have stayed away from Mogan David. You know what I mean? As a matter of fact. You know what I mean? It didn't happen because of that. It didn't matter that I was religious, okay? It only happened when I cried out to him to help me. And that only happened, you know, I am constantly amazed. I look, I came to the Lord like the Apostle Paul came to the Lord. I'm Saul. I came to the Lord like Saul came to the Lord. Beaten down, blinded, talking to him on the road, feeling like that's how I came to the Lord. So, you know, that's the way I feel. People come to the Lord. I mean, it's my experience. I could be wrong. I don't know anything, but I feel that's how you come to the Lord. You get crushed and you come to the Lord. It so happens that it's been my experience working with alcoholics, addicts, and people that I see a lot of people come to the Lord that way. And I see a lot of people that are haughty and prideful and not beating down, find it impossible to rely on God. But every once in a while, I'll meet somebody in my life who has a relationship with the Lord and loves the Lord and everything. They're brought up in a Christian home, and they never experienced horrible stuff. You know? I mean, to me, these people are like angels. I don't even understand these people. I mean, I love them. They're my friends now. I don't get it. You know what I mean? I really don't. I have friends that were brought up in Christian homes, and they're Christians from the get-go, and they love the Lord, and I know their love is strong, and I know they have faith. And in a strange sense, I've got to be honest with you, I feel sorry for them. You know what I mean? I feel sorry that they missed the experience of being crushed. But, you know, I guess, you know, the Lord has his reasons why, you know, these people need to find the Lord too. Even well people need the Lord. You know what I mean? Even though I know he came for the broken ones. But the bottom line is that what I also know is that there are Christians who believe in God or say they believe in God and go to church and everything like that, but they're barren. They're defeated. They're not in the Lord. They don't have the enthusiasm for the Lord because it's been a long time since they've said, or maybe they've never said, God help me. Because God help me only comes when you really believe that you need God's help. You know, I'm not talking about Chase Manhattan help me, or Mommy help me, or Daddy help me, or Mr. Spatz, will you help me? You know what I mean? Or not lawyer help me or something. I'm talking about where there's no help is anywhere and you're all alone and nothing's going to help and you just got nothing left to do but turn to the Lord. And you know something? The truth of the matter is that happens to Christians and that happens to non-Christians. You know? And so sometimes I don't assume just because somebody's sitting in a pew or somebody knows the Bible, I don't assume that they know the Lord. Or they have a relationship with the Lord. You know, or that the Lord is something, or that they are have a working relationship with the Lord, where he's constantly on their mind, where they're constantly thinking about him all the time, and praising him all the time, and thinking about what he thinks about them all the time. And I'm certainly not perfect on this deal, but what this program has given me, what the fellowship has given me, what the word has given me, what hanging around with the people that I hang around with have given me, what the spiritual exercises have given me, what, quite frankly, the trials have given me. James chapter 1, what the trials have given me. Thank God for trials. Amen. You know, I'm almost scared sometimes to say thank God for trials because, you know, you got to be very careful how you talk to the Lord. You know, listen, I just want to let you know, next time you say, God, I want to be closer to you, you better read the word and understand exactly what you're asking for, you know? Because when the Apostle Paul said, I had a thorn in my side, it was satanic, it was killing me. I asked them to remove it. God said, I will not take this away. To stop me from being conceited, he says, when you're weak, I'm strong. Sort of gives you the indirect idea that maybe he planted that thorn in the first place. You know what I mean? I have it there for a reason. The Apostle Paul called it satanic. God said, you're missing the point. Be careful what you call satanic. Maybe some of the stuff I'm doing to you, I did it to bring, you know, you look at some of the great heroes in the Bible. Who's a great hero? David? David, great hero? What did the Lord do to him to bring him back? Sure, he was riding high for a while. He believed in God. He loved the Lord. He believed in God. He's one of God's chosen, right? You remember? He went out there. Look how great I am. I'm sitting on the throne. I'm fooling around with Bathsheba. I'm killing her husband and everything like that. You remember when Nathan went over to see him? You are that man. Brought him to his knees to bring him back. Crushed him to bring him back. What did he do to Abraham? When Abraham had to make that sacrifice, his only son that he loved, you know, where did he bring Abraham? What did he call for him to do? To bring him back into the fold. Be careful when you start thinking about how close you want to be to God. Because he has a way of getting you to the point where you really will rely on him. And it's not by necessarily giving you all the money. It may be by taking away the money. It may not be by giving you a husband. It may be by taking away your husband or taking away your kid. He may put you in a position where you got nothing left but him. You know, and Christians need to understand this. And I know that there's a reason why the Lord said it's easier for, you know, a camel to go through the eye of the needle than a rich man to get into heaven. And I believe there are wealthy people that are good people that love the Lord and have a real relationship. Hey, listen, I hope so. I'm banking on it. You know what I mean? I don't say, don't give me the money. You know what I mean? I'm a Christian. You know, I'm banking. But I'm telling you something. You got to be careful when you get too self-reliant. And he somehow, you know, he's put me in a position, you know, I've got that yoke on where, you know, he's giving me all the good stuff and he gives me the trials. He gives it to me sort of like evenly spaced out. You know, okay, he gave me a wife. She pounds me a little bit. You know what I mean? She's good for me, you know. And the bottom line is that I want to be able to always have the idea when I wake up in the morning and I go to sleep at night that everything depends upon him. I always want to be focused on him and thinking about him. I'm not perfect on this, but I'll tell you what, compared to the way I used to be, now I think about him all the time. And so that's why, you know, when your perspective is thinking about Jesus, thinking about the Lord, praising him, thinking what he's given you, you know, not only does it wash over you, it affects other people. You know, Joel and I was having a conversation. He was talking to me about his life, you know, and I know Joel's been through tough spots, and he's where I was maybe 30 years ago. And talking about how rough things are and how bad things are and everything like that. And I said, you know, how he screwed up his life. And the first thing I think, because this is the way I think, this is just the way I think now. Because I was a self-pityaholic. I used to think my life, how I screwed up my life. And he says, I screwed up my life. And the first thing I start thinking, I'm saying, what do you mean your life? Who told you it was your life? You have nothing. You wouldn't even have this life if Jesus didn't give it to you. All things were made for him, through him. It's his. You screwed up his life. You screwed up the life he gave you. Why don't you start thinking about how you screwed up his life? You know, his life. What did I do with his life? How can I make amends to him? Boy, there's a big difference in thinking about how I screwed up my life and how I screwed up his life. Because I start thinking about how I screwed up his life, I start thinking like maybe I owe him something. What can I do? You know what the Apostle Paul says? He said, worldly sorrow or self-pity. Worldly sorrow, sorrow about what happened in the world, leads to death. But godly sorrow leads to salvation. There's a big difference between feeling sorry for yourself and sorry for where you have allowed yourself to become with a loving God looking over you. What you have done to ashamed God, to in the face of God, how you've disappointed God, to be embarrassed or ashamed for what you've become, which is the way David was when he said, you were that man. So, you know, it seems kind of interesting. You know, we all assume that all the Christians in the pulpit, you know, just have this abiding faith that they're living with every single day. You know, maybe it's sort of true. Well, I'll tell you, it's probably more true for the Christians in the pulpit than the Christians that are not in the pulpit, because at least they come to church. You know what I'm talking about? But, you know, even Christians in the pulpit, and me certainly, I need to be able to see, you know, because of denial and because of the way we think also, sometimes it's very difficult to see in your own life where you're playing God. You know, it says in the big book this line, first of all, we had to quit playing God. We had to stop being self-reliant. We had to stop being God-reliant. Well, I'm such a human doing instead of a human being. I'm running around from here to there. I'm planning. I'm doing this. You got to do this. You got to do that. You know, sometimes you can get totally swamped and overwhelmed with running your life and managing your life and not even thinking about God, that you don't even see. You don't even get where you're not allowing God to come into your life. And I don't even know how to explain that. The best way I can talk about it is this way. I'm fully capable of being self-run riot and totally running my life and forget about God. And that is why it is such a blessing that I do things like this. Because I believe, at least for my own life, you will be basically who you will be 5 years from now. Who you are tonight is the result of who you hang out with and the books you read. And really, the books you read are based upon who you hang out with. So look, last night I was at a meeting doing the second step. Tonight I'm at this meeting. Every day I go to lunch with Christian guys. You understand what I'm saying? Tomorrow morning, Bible study. Saturday morning, I'm doing. Sunday, I'm in church in the morning. Sunday night, I'm in church. Now, to Monday, you guys, Monday, I'm doing, you know, there's Monday, there's Bible study. In other words, there's every day that goes by, I'm somehow, some way connected with Christians or with people that are talking about the Bible. Now, you may think this is crazy. It's not. Well, listen, you know, I know guys in my prior life, every day I was connected with guys that were hunting in order to get laid. Every day was a day to go to the bar in order to have sex or to find a woman or to get a date. It's not any more crazy than that. And you know something? And I'll tell you something. It suits me a lot better. So everybody in this world is involved in focusing on something. Hey, every day is a day where politicians can focus on being reelected. What makes me crazy, because I focus on the Lord and hanging out with people who want to talk about the Lord, where a politician, all he does is focus on what the politics are, what the polls are, or something like that. We're all focused on something, and who you are and what kind of character you are and what you have is going to depend upon what you're feasting on, what you're eating on, what you're focusing on, where your focus is. That's what Jesus said in Matthew. And, you know, maybe I'm just sicker than most. You know, maybe this is what I need in order to focus on the Lord. You know, the deal is this. If all I did was do everything I do today without hanging around with this Christian fellowship or reading the Word or stuff like that, I'd be a human doing. I probably wouldn't even think about the Lord. But, you know, I have these great fellowships and I have these great things like this where I can think a little bit about what I'm going to say before I come in here tonight. Then I can say this thing. Then I can leave with another Christian brother with Steve. We'll drop home. We'll talk about it. And then I'll go to sleep and I'll wake up tomorrow morning. I'll go to Bible study. So my working life, and I'm working, my working life is interspersed every hour, every 2 hours, every 5 hours, with a little bit of recess. Remember in school you had recess? Where I get to hang out with Jesus. And so what happens is there's like a half-life effect of that. There's like a hangover effect of that. It sort of washes over the rest of my life. So what happens is even though I may go to lunch and talk to the guys about Jesus, and we'll talk about the Lord, and we'll talk about different things for about an hour, hour and a half. When I go back to the office, I'm going to be working on legal stuff, but I'm thinking about him. And somehow when I'm talking to Joel, I'm thinking, he's telling me about his life, and I'm thinking about Jesus. You know, I'm thinking, he's not thinking about Jesus, but I'm thinking about Jesus. You know, and he starts telling me stuff. I said, well, but what about Jesus? It's the most natural thing in the world for me. He's going like, what do you mean? What are you talking to me about Jesus? I'm a Christian. I said, you're a Christian. Well, what about Jesus? It's because of the way I see things, because of the fellowship I hang around, the way I'm looking at things. It's all about the second step. All understanding that I'm insane without Jesus. It doesn't matter what the circumstances are. I'm insane without Jesus. But if I focus on him and I focus on the Lord, somehow it keeps me sane. It keeps me, you know, the Bible talks about be sober. It's interesting. The Bible says be sober. Sober in the Bible means of sound mind. I'm of sound mind. I can make sound judgments. I can decide who I can hang around with. You know, I'll tell you one thing. I am, I'll leave it at this. If I am anything, I am a self-pityaholic. My mother was a self-pityaholic. I couldn't stand her. I said, I never want to be like my mother, sitting around drinking, feeling sorry for herself, crying in her beer. And I said, I'll never be like her. And I turned into her, exactly like her. Pour me, pour me, pour me a drink. Sitting by the record player, playing the same record only over and over again, only the lonely. You know what I mean? Or whatever. So, rainy days and Mondays, you know what I mean? Over and over again, all that good stuff that can get you feeling even more and more sorry for yourself. And I became one of those self-pityaholics, always wrapped up in myself. And I can tell you this. Not only haven't I found it necessary to take a drink in 30 years, I haven't found it necessary to feel sorry for myself in a long time. I'm not saying it never happens. Every once in a while I catch it. I'll snap at somebody, or I'll feel mad, or somebody will disappoint me, you know what I mean? And I'll feel so, you know, but I snap out of it. I realize what's going on. So I'm not perfect in this deal. But it's all because of where my focus is. Focus is on the Lord, focus is on Jesus. So next week, we'll talk about step three. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.